I was just going to say one thing. I told Chris this. If a group of people are running and yelling fire really loud in a theater, I would start running with them. And I don't consider that conformity. I consider that rational behavior based on reasonably good information. But yes, it looks like conformity on perhaps one angle of it.
So, yeah. So, I'm glad, Chris, with K, you're disagreeing, because obviously if we all are in agreement, then it's a boring discussion. So I'll try and edit bringing this back in now. Like, Chris, based on what we said, what are your thoughts on...
I think there were some follow-on experiments, if I understand correctly, where they actually attempted to decide between those two possibilities, where they, I think what they did is they allowed people to give their answer privately. So this is a equivalent to, I guess, the secret ballot. So when they're allowed to give their answer privately without the Confederates knowing their answer, their level of conformity did go way down, I think, if I read correctly. So that, I think, maybe argues more that there's a social pressure that the people are dealing with. And I think that's a little bit different than the conformity a bit, because social pressure has a lot to do with not suffering the consequences of your nonconformity, as opposed to really changing your viewpoint. I think we might understand that follow-on experiment.
I agree with that. So if I was in that experiment, there would be, for me though, I wouldn't do it. I would give the right answer.
Yeah.
You know,
that's what's really interesting. There is 25% of the population they measured will not conform. I would have thought it'd be even lower, closer to 5%. But I think that's, I think that's the interesting population. You know, what is the?
Yeah, I think what 5 or 10% of the world still believes in a flat Earth, right? Even after hundreds of years of.
You might like this, Phil. Do you recall the Star Trek episode where Captain Picard is a prisoner? And he's being tortured, and all he has to do is he sees lights, and he has to say the accurate number, or what they want him to say for the number of lights, and he refuses to do it. You know, he wants to maintain integrity at all times. And so when we talk about, you said, consequences for nonconformity, I mean, that could mean death, right? And torture.
Yes.
Yes. Conformity is has real consequences.
That's right. Yeah. Sometimes people get very angry. Even a crowd can get very angry at someone who disagrees. And they can do serious bodily harm to that person. But you know, there is an algorithm, right, that runs in the brain of animals, which is what other animals do is good. And safe. For example, animals will look at what other animals are eating and say, well, if they're eating it, I can eat it. Okay. So that's, it's a rational program on one level of rationality. You know, it's not deductive reasoning, but it still reduces risk. And so, in your example, the crowd yelling fire, you know, you can say, well, I have a risk of missing my appointment. I have a risk of looking bad if this is not true, but my risk of dying on the other side because I didn't pay attention to that scream of fire outweighs my risk of, you know, whatever else of the nonconformity. So I think those are separate algorithms that work in the brain as well. And, you know, they're powerful.
So, Chris,
I think with type of reasoning, so you said it wasn't deductive reasoning. I think it's statistical analysis, essentially. So when you see a large number of the same type of being you are engaging in an activity, that statistic reduces the risk of that activity. It's mimicry is in nature. It's part of our biology for a reason, because the success of other organisms means that, it's, you know, we should do that same thing.
Right. And that's, you know, so the thing I think about, and I've been thinking about this for years, is a strange question, but I think about, you know, wildebeest, right? So wildebeests will always run when lions chase them. And if you're a wildebeest and you see wildebeest start to run, to your analogy, you don't have to wait till you see the lion. In fact, if you do wait till you see the lion, chances are you'll be the wildebeest that gets eaten. But the nonconformity thing comes into my mind because wildebeests to me seem extremely well designed to confront a lion and defeat a lion, yet they run. So, but it seems to me that if you had one lion in 20, maybe even one wildebeest in 20, even one in 50, if that wildebeest for some reason had a genetic quirk that made that wildebeest a non-conformer, that wildebeest would be extremely dangerous to lions, because these lions would be running at breakneck speed trying to catch a wildebeest. And here you'd have a wildebeest trucking in the opposite direction, right? And all this wildebeest has to do is lower his head once and make contact with that lion, and that lion is ended. So I think about in terms of nonconformers and what their value is in society, and that they have a potential to provide a protection to the rest of the group that is very high, even if they pay a very high price for being a nonconformer. So anyway, I used to wonder about what is the value of having these people who say no in society, right? Who refuse to go along with the crowd. But I think about that crazy wildebeest who instead of running away from lions, runs towards them.
Chris, I'll comment on one thing you did say. What's the value of the people who say no in society?
Yes.
Eric Fromm, the social psychologist, wrote an excellent book called A Sane Society. And he describes basically, I mean, we've got to ask ourselves, is the world, the state, society we're living in, the ideal one? And, you know, if we say it's not, then we have to say no. And that's, you know, to change what it is to what it should be. So that's highly valuable.
Yeah, the non-conformity.
Highly valuable to society.
Go ahead.
Well, I would say perhaps highly valuable to society, highly detrimental to the non-conformer, quite often.
Well, they even became martyrs. Galileo, the list goes on
for
people who were martyred and tortured for non-conforming, even though they were right.
Yeah. Even entrepreneurs, obviously, I'm not going to put an entrepreneur in the same realm as a Galileo or other more modern representations, but yeah, they look like fools for a long period of time until the crowd kind of comes around to them. So I mean, when Henry Ford, he didn't actually invent, he just really invented the assembly line, but there were lots of people back then saying, we have a perfectly good horse, why would somebody be driving around in that? When the telephone came out, they said that cities would be obsolete, you know, people aren't going to be interacting anymore, and all of these crazy, and then of course all of the Luddite, whenever they had the textile manufacturing, people would sabotage the manufacturing because they thought it was going to ruin all of human values, and technology is going to bring all this harm on the world. So yeah, there's the nonconformists in social movements, and as far as in business, entrepreneurs, musicians, artists, you can go on and on. So yeah, absolutely. They bear the brunt. In fact, Herman Melville, with Moby Dick, that book didn't become famous until long after he died. There's lots of, you could give examples that they weren't. Tesla, actually, the man, he was a brilliant man. He was a horrible business person, but a brilliant man, and he died in poverty in a hotel. And now the company that bears his name is worth $250 billion. I like
Ayn Rand's vision of the world in terms of this alone, perhaps. She sees, you know, sponges and fountains, you know, and the sponges conform and they're part of the crowd, and but they're fountains occasionally. They're Michelangelo's and Mozart's that re-envision what the world could be in dramatic ways.
Well, let's get back to the ash experiment. The spirit of the ash experiment is that people will conform, not necessarily to, and we gave this example earlier as far as, let's say they're trying to ingratiate themselves to a particular opposite sex or same sex, or if they're in their particular business setting or social setting, then they're trying to ingratiate themselves. If you bracket that out, and there's still, I would say, examples, like you said, Chris, with the C, 25% are nonconformist. But what the really interesting part is, if they nonconform, knowing that's not the right answer, number one. And then number two, they do it in where they're not going to really going to be advanced in their particular station. So there's lots of examples in high school where people will ruin their lives with drugs and other things. But Chris, with the C, do you, what are your thoughts as far as just representations? Let's say if we start on the business side, like in 99, 2000, was that not an example? Chris with a K disagrees with me, but I would argue that that was an example in some sense of the Solomon Asch, as far as just, you know, most of the time, a lot of times it's rational to go with the crowd. But Daniel Kahneman talks about this in his book, Thinking Fast and Slow. And there are other times when you need to use that slower form of thinking.
Yeah, you know, I would say that there's a combination of the two dynamics for both happening. Because rationally, if everybody says the stock is worth more, then in some sense, it's worth more. That's what the definition of the value is. On the other hand, I actually was in one of those startup companies, and some weird reasons I was in one of those startup companies with a guy named Kurzweil, the futurist.
Yeah, Raymond.
Ray Kurzweil.
Oh, are you serious? Ray Kurzweil?
Yeah, I was in his. There's a professor. There's a very technology savvy professor, great guy, and he said to me, "Hey, you want to do some part time work?" I was like, "Yeah, sure, okay." So I ended up working for him, and not knowing that it was actually in Ray Kurzweil's company, and I ended up being in some of those meetings. And so the scenario I'm thinking about is, at one point there was a decision about buying a domain name for the company, and you know, and somebody had the domain name because somebody had, you know, squatted on it, and at some point it came along to, you know, they wanted a lot of money for it. I thought, well, you know, we're not going to pay that kind of money. That money's ridiculous, right? Maybe it was $100,000. I don't remember what it was. Maybe it was $80,000. Come to find out, I think we had next meeting, they paid $325,000 for a domain name. And I was blown away, right? That they had paid three, because I didn't think the name was that great. But in that environment, that's what things go for, right? And so I'm sure there were domain names that went for $1 million at that time. I think that there's some aspect of it which, you know, there people think that's what it's worth. But I think there's another aspect, which is no one wants to say no in that environment. Because part of the .com thing was, it was cool to be .com, right? It was cool to have this new version or vision of what things are worth, what people were worth. Because they in a .com, people make a lot of money. Yeah. With the exception of me, because I was doing this part-time thing, okay? But the other people working at the company were making amazing money, okay? I don't remember the numbers, but secretaries, everybody was making tons of money relative to normal life. And I think that was sort of the cool thing about the dot-com vision, which was, hey, everything's worth a different amount of money than it was yesterday or than it is outside of this building. And no one has any incentive to say it's not. But I think on the one hand it's the rational in the terms of, you know, what is that other monkey eating, right? Other monkey's eating it, it's okay to eat it. But I think on the other hand, there was also some pressure to not stand up and say, look, I don't think anybody should pay more than $3,000 for a domain name no matter what, right? No one was going to say that in that environment, I think.
But so let me dig deeper on this. So like, we can use a more recent example. Marijuana company is a little.
By the way, it's terrible to give these personal vignettes. I mean, that's self-identifying.
Yeah, well,
I'm tempted at times to avoid.
I should have said I heard there was a company once.
I can edit.
I'll just tell you a story from work, but
I wanted to dive deep into this. So there's marijuana companies. Not too long ago, a little over a year ago, for like a 3-4 month time frame. There's lots of small companies. They just changed the name of their company and included that on there. And the stock tripled, quadrupled. We saw this with Bitcoin in the last 24 months or so, or blockchain. Companies would just change the name of their company and have no material revenues, or and then their stock would go crazy. And in other examples, where a company would have, let's say, the name of Zoom, there would be a similar sounding company, like in another country, maybe it's domiciled, and the company would go up like crazy. So my point is, and so far I'm not getting this from Chris with a K, but there are times that people will engage in a mass movement that is not rational, is what I'm trying to argue here. And I think that does exist. It's not obviously all the time, especially in business, but there are times that you will see craziness manifested, relatively often, actually. Do you disagree with that?
My point is, I have two of them. Let me start off with the first, what I was going to say second. That's the difference between zero-sum games and games where everybody can win. So zero-sum games are, as you know, where if one person wins, the other person loses. There are other types of games where everybody wins, and following the crowd means that literally everybody could rise from, some technology or, and following the crowd is a rational strategy because there's wisdom in crowds. Like Chris said, if 1,000 wildebeest are running and you're not running, you better start running if you're a wildebeest because something is going down. And so it's a rational strategy.
Maybe I'm not articulating it very well, but are there not instances where mass of people, the crowds, is wrong and people are pursuing what the crowd is doing for really no reason?
Let me just answer that and I'll turn it over to Chris. That's exactly what I'm saying. I mean, certainly it's when you follow a crowd, it doesn't mean that the crowd is right. There's the wisdom of crowds and the evil of crowds. So crowds, such as in Nazi Germany, if everybody decided to join the Third Reich and you're going, well, let me follow the crowd, it's evil. So I'm not saying the crowd is always right, but I'm saying that's the motivation. The assumption is, with a lack of information, you assume the crowd has wisdom.
Let me bring you in on Vinny. What are your thoughts on this? So I'm trying to argue that maybe it's part of the reptilian brain. The neocortex is not really incorporating that, or in Daniel Kahneman's think, system one and system two, there's a defect with humanity or the way humans are engineered, that we're not on the savannah anymore. And when you're on the savannah and there's some beast running at you, then it makes sense to run now. But now that we're in a world of bits and atoms and computers and so forth, as far as just with, if you go with tulips 400 years ago or blockchain and people putting all their money in things just because somebody else is doing it without looking at the facts, looking at the data and taking a more calm, patient approach, does that not exist at times with the crowds?
I think both phenomena certainly are going to exist. There's going to be times when the crowd is right and when they're wrong. I mean, it's interesting when people say, think for yourself, and it's just like, if you actually heard what those people thought, then you might not say that anymore. I mean, just because you say think for yourself, I mean, you might be talking to, you might be thinking of yourself or your peers, and your peers might have the capacity to do some good original thinking, but they're not. They're just being lazy or they're just conforming. But that doesn't mean that everybody really should, everybody who thinks for themselves would be thinking rational thoughts. I mean, what if everybody thinks for themselves and they end up as Nazis? I don't know. I mean, I think there's an inherent, in this kind of discussion, there's an inherent assumption that independent thought is going to be good, is going to have merit or something, when it might not. I mean, so I don't know. I think in everyday life, both things appear. I don't really think that we have much empirical data. But basically, I would just say it would have to be within a certain context. And also, I mean, like Chris, both Chris's were saying, I mean, at times it's going to be rational, if only in your rational self-interest, to go along with the crowd. I mean, at times it might be rational because they're right, but other times the social pressure part of it might come up where it's, I mean,
let's say there's the other aspect too. So there's a reason to believe that the crowd has wisdom. So that's why we follow it. There are social consequences to not following the crowd. So there's a, you know, rational reason in terms of harm and benefit. But there's also the third aspect. And I think, Phil, maybe I think the Solomon Asch experiment tries to look at this one the most, and that's the psychological need for belonging. That we follow crowds because we want to belong. That's a powerful need.
But that's more of like a short-term and a long-term. You mentioned Picard, and that's a great example that Picard is willing to go through torture to always be true. This is a Shakespeare, a Hamlet line, be true to thy own self. So you're going, I think you would admire somebody that, sure, you're going to have some alienation in the short term if you're always pursuing the path that you think is right. But in the long term, if you live a long enough life, then you're going to be admired for going with that. What do you think, Chris C?
I think we appreciate and are aware of those people who have been vindicated by time. But I suspect there are a minority of the people who think differently. I suspect the vast majority of people who think differently end up dying at the point where people still think that they're crazy.